Hello, welcome to Pod Bless Texas. I'm Louise Soler, and I'm here with my co-host, Kendall Stutter.
Hi, how are you?
We're outside of our studio, and we're so happy to have our third mic today, our good friend and awesome Dallas socialite,
Lorenzo Boutram Hubbard.
Luca Shea, the gay socialite, the Dallas socialite, the, I don't remember the rest.
Brickle.
The Brickle?
Yes.
What's Brickle?
That's the very posh area of Miami.
Oh, yes. The Brickle socialite?
Yes.
The Million Dollar Decorator alumnus.
Hello, all.
For those who don't know, that is how Lorenzo always introduces himself. So
everywhere, even at the grocery store.
We're so glad you moved to Dallas versus Miami. Aren't you glad you're not in Miami now?
No.
Oh, really?
It's hot as hell here.
Yeah, it is.
Well, it's hot as hell in Miami, too.
But there's an ocean. Yes.
Girl. But during this COVID, you're not happy you're here with us here in Dallas?
Well, the numbers are going up in both places, so I don't know. At least, I mean, here I'm in a house.
Yeah.
And in Miami, I'm in a condominium.
Yeah,
so it's like my whole neighborhood in Dallas is in one building.
Yeah.
So that is a difference.
Quick reminder to those who are listening or watching, we are outside of our studio. We are still working from home. As a result, we don't have like the right number of microphones or earpieces or all that stuff. So we're doing our best.
Try.
Our microphones are clipped onto Lorenzo and Lillian because I'm loud as fuck. And so we're just going to do our best to make it this way.
When you guys do your karaoke together, do you all ever sing together?
We have
sing together.
Yes.
Nice.
Well, we're going to save all of that for when we have a Pod Bless event one day and people can come to
okay.
it.
That'll
be
great. That'll be fun.
When the world reopens. Awesome. And we have a great guest today, a Democratic candidate from the Houston area who's running against that asshole Representative McCall in District 10, Dr. Pratish Gandhi.
All right.
Yeah, so he's going to be on.
McCall's in District 10, right?
Yeah.
So uh-huh. I was putting two in there for
yeah.
some reason.
It's 10.
I'm yeah. a dummy. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so he's in a contested primary.
There is a contested primary in that race. It will be between Dr. Pratish Gandhi and Mike Siegel, who was the 2018 candidate. We like them both. They are great people. Mike Siegel was just endorsed by Bernie Sanders mm-hmm. this week. Unfortunately, we just have a limited amount of time to get people on the show. Hopefully, we'll be able to have Mike on before the runoff. But Pratish is going to be on this week, and he's a great guy. We love Pratish, and you'll
he's
get
awesome.
To learn about him a little yeah. bit this
and
week.
And I would say look at their platforms because they're not exactly the same.
Right.
Right.
So you have to decide what issue is most important to you.
I mean, I am not one of those people that like to get pissy during primaries unless...
We're all Democrats.
Yeah, sometimes you have races where you have...
Clearly.
Very clear choices, like the Railroad Commission race, vote for Krista Castaneda.
Not once, but twice. But
right. But then you have races like this one where they're both really great candidates and really good people that just have different visions. But, mm-hmm. you know, we're all in the same party, and whoever it is, we're going to kill it in November.
Yes. Yeah. Mostly make sure... all of our listeners vote in the contested primaries July 14th because they really matter.
Yeah, and we have it as a headline, but I guess we can go ahead and say it now. Deadline to register to vote in this July runoff is going to be June 15th, which is Monday.
Monday.
As soon as you hear this, if you're not registered to vote, get your shit together. If you listen to this show and you're not registered to vote...
Don't even. Anyway. We're so excited. So what's else been going on for you?
For me, I mean, I've really been just kind of, you know, chilling and trying to get work done. I mean, here's the thing. Working from home is great, and I really like social distancing. The problem I'm finding with it is that now that every meeting is a Zoom meeting, there are 1,000 more meetings, and everyone expects you to be on them because they're so easy to get on. And so I may have, like, 8 Zoom meetings in a night now. Like, I'm just drowning.
Yeah, I think there's some kind of everybody needs to do a reset because you normally wouldn't take that many meetings, in-person meetings in your regular life. Like, you wouldn't take 12 meetings on the Hill or to go do persuasion or advocacy, and now we're doing 12 meetings on these subjects, and it's like it's not
everybody
sustainable.
Just really wants to be on Zoom these days.
Yes,
for some
they do. Yes. How about you? How are you doing with this?
Well, work-wise, I'm still working, but it's very difficult to be a socialite when you can't socialize.
What is a socialite? What qualifies someone to be a socialite?
A socialite is a person who is well-known in social circles. I think that a socialite, a true socialite, is not just someone who has fabulous bags.
And although those are, you do.
Thank you. And those all the right places to go. But I think that you should be well known in different social circles, not just people who look like you.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah.
So if you're one of those little Susie Swarshenickses and all the people who know you go to the same club. I don't know. I just made up a name. I tried to pick a name that nobody had. And everybody looks like you, talks like you. You go to the same places. Your husbands all know each other. Girl, you're not a socialite. That's just a dinner party.
Those people are philanthropists.
Well, we'll call it that. They're giving the money back. So I would. So I think socialites are people who are very well known in many social circles.
Okay.
Like I am.
Are we socialites?
Like I am.
Relatively well known in some
circles. It does not count when you're knowing people from your home.
There
you have to be out amongst the people.
All right. Now that you can transition, I mean, I love your socialite, but the times we are in right now, I wanted to talk about when Kendall and I got together today. I was about an hour late. Sorry. Actually, my clocks are all set wrong. Uh-huh. I'm going to blame it on that again. But Lorenzo, this time that we're living in these protests, I mean, you're a former Chicago police. Detroit police officer.
Yes.
What, give us what this is meaning to you, and what are you seeing, and how are you feeling?
Well, you know, what we're going through right now.
It's so much.
I get to talk about it on so many different levels because I'm the product of a biracial family. Who were together, who were married in the 1920s when it was illegal for biracial people to be married.
Oh, wow.
I joined the police department.
Did you know you were gay when you joined the police department?
Yes, I was the first openly gay police officer. Okay. So,
Did they know?
Yeah, I was the first openly gay police officer. I joined a police department at a time, which is, you know, so when I see these things going on now, it's like I'm looking at them through different eyes than many. Because when I joined the police department in 87, there were still officers there who were the officers who sicked dogs on people and water hoses and hit them in heads with their clubs and stuff during the riots in Detroit. They were now officers who had 20, 21 years, 22 years, and they were sergeants and lieutenants, or just officers with seniority. These officers were still there. Women had only been working the street for about 10 or 12 years. My mother was one of the first women to work the street
working
in
the
Detroit.
Street as police officers? Working,
yes. Uh-huh. And I was gay. So you had all of these happening at the same time. Black officers fighting for their rights, working with racist officers, women fighting for their rights to work the street, and a gay officer also fighting for the right to be able to work the street. So it all was there. I was there for all of it. Oh my goodness. When I saw what happened in Minnesota, I know what it's like to be a young officer that comes out of the academy, and as soon as you arrive at the precinct, they tell you to forget everything you learned in the academy because now this is the real world. And you're put in a scout car with an officer who is 20 years on the job, and they tell you, sit down, shut up, don't do anything. You do what I tell you to do or you're going to lose your job. That happens. I want you guys to know that's how it is when you are a brand new officer coming out of the academy, going to work the street. You are terrified that if you say anything, do anything, that you're going to lose your job. So it takes a very strong person to be a police officer, because you have to be someone from the day you graduate from the academy that is able to see wrong and be able to say, I don't care if I'm going to lose my job. If I see something being done wrong, I have to make sure that I say something.
A little correction, though. It takes a really strong person to be a good police officer.
Yeah, it takes a, well, to be a police officer, we all are supposed to follow the same ethics. Okay. It's not like there's one ethic for you graduate from the academy and there's the good door and the bad door. You know, this is the good code of ethics and this is the bad code of ethics.
But as, a black man watching that video of Mr. Floyd and seeing that officer that did the deed and seeing that young officer, probably that I'm showing my age on this, Did you feel anything? I mean, obviously, everybody involved needs to be, you know, dealt with. That guy that was only on the police force for 4 days following that boss, I'm just looking at it from maybe as a mother and going also for, it just seems the kind of justice dealt to him is certainly one needs, but golly, 4 days, he was doing exactly what you said, following that other guy's order. Does he deserve that?
I think that I really do not believe, and I might be unpopular with some, I really don't believe that the young officers knew that what he was doing was going to kill this man. Should they have known? Yes.
Right.
Did they know? Probably not. Should they have stopped him and said, what are you doing? Absolutely.
Absolutely. Right.
They should have stopped him. They should have said something. They should have called for a supervisor. And when you are an officer and you see another officer doing something and you don't know how to stop them, you still have the power to call for a supervisor. Mm-hmm. There was enough time for one of those officers to call for a supervisor and for a supervisor to arrive at the scene. This man was on his neck for almost 9 minutes. That was enough time for an officer to see what was going on, say, I don't feel comfortable with this. I'm going to call for a supervisor. Mm-hmm. And you can ask to be taken out of repeat on a radio. So that officer doesn't even have to know that you're calling for a supervisor.
Right? Okay.
You can ask so that you could talk to radio and then you could say whatever. You could say, hey, can you send a supervisor, mm-hmm. whatever. There are ways that officers can call for a supervisor. Supervisor could have been there in a couple minutes. Mm-hmm. And maybe a supervisor would have handled that situation. Mm-hmm. I would like to think that a supervisor would have arrived there, because my mother being a supervisor, my grandfather being a supervisor, they would have arrived at the scene and taken control of the situation, and that man would still be alive. That's what I would like to think. Mm-hmm. So there was incredible failure on the part of those young officers in their training, because even in the academy, you are still taught that if you see an officer doing something wrong, mm-hmm. how to handle that.
Right. Yeah, that culture that you see, I mean, I'm saying for sure, I don't know what it's like to be a African-American, but to see that kind of, male behavior, where you're just sitting there watching someone do a bad thing. I mean, to me, just over my career, seeing bad behavior in corporate structures, government structures, military structures against women and people of color, it just seems like the same behavior. This behavior of together, I don't know how to speak up, because it's all like, I don't want to say frat culture because that's not fair to all the frat culture, but it's almost like this culture of, you know,
and when here on Pie Bless Texas, we like to make sure we're fair to frat culture.
Right.
Sure.
No, it's just this, but this culture of, you know, I didn't know how to stop him. So when Kavanaugh got, you know, appointed and no one stopped him when he attacked this woman when he was 17, everybody think that's okay. We just forgive the people. Why aren't these young men?
Well, let's be correct. We forgive white men. Because when the young black officer shot the white woman
here in Dallas,
there was a black officer in that same city who shot a white, who had not been on the job that long as well, who shot a white woman, and he was prosecuted and he went to jail. And because he used his weapon in a way that was not trained to be used. And he did not use due diligence when it came to firing his weapon. I know what it's like to shoot somebody. Mm-hmm. I do. It's not a fun thing. You don't want to do it. And if any officer, anybody out there thinks that goes to work, any officer goes to work thinking, oh, I can, you know, I want to shoot my gun. I like guns or whatever. You shouldn't be a police officer.
Right.
You should not absolutely 100% be a police officer. My mother told me from the very beginning, if there are different types of people who are police officers, there are people who make the uniform or the uniform makes you. So and if you're one of those people that the uniform makes you, then you should not be a police officer. You should not.
Well, we also have one more very special guest that's going to be joining us today. We have Delia Parker Mims, who's running for county commissioner in Denton County. It's a super important seat. It's a very flippable seat, but your county commissioners and your lower level elected officials are really important, and we haven't done a whole lot to cover those. So Delia Parker Mims from Denton County will be joining us today to talk about commissioner's courts and what we can do to help flip some of those down ballot seats.
Right. Hers is a winnable seat out in Denton County, which is one of the fastest growing counties in Texas.
Yeah, and it's the county where they just pulled down their big Confederate statue that it's been this long-standing argument. So very excited to have her join us this week.
Great. So. Well, that's great. So we have two guests. And but before we do that, as always, we have to start with Hit the Headline. Yeah. All right. Coronavirus in Texas. 1,206,320 tests have been administered in the state, which has 29 million people. 81,000 Texans tested positive for coronavirus as of 6/11. Let's see, 1,900.
It's
not good.
It's 1,800 more than the day before and 11,663 more than the week before. I need you to keep that open. And then 1,920 Texans have actually died from coronavirus, 35 more than the day before, 153 more than 1 week ago. Numbers on the rise. We actually have had the single highest increase in coronavirus diagnoses in the state of Texas this week on Wednesday.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Why?
I did go out when everything opened, like that first week, because I wanted to see how things were functioning. And I'm not going to say the name of the places I went because I don't want to call people out. But I went to a place in Addison, and they had live music. The people were over the age of 60, dancing. It was just people were jumping up from one table to another. There was no social distancing. No one had on a mask. No one took a temperature, nothing.
People aren't wearing masks. I don't understand that.
Employees are wearing masks.
Yeah.
But most of the places, I would say almost every place I've gone to that has been a nighttime or entertainment venue, restaurant, club, or anything like that that has been able to open, no one has had on a mask, and any of those, the customers have not had on a mask. And even the employees are having on masks, but they pull them down below their nose because they said they can't breathe.
Well, Wednesday was the largest single day of diagnoses since this started in Texas, and we earned it. Yeah. I mean, it's like we got bored with it and quit.
Yeah.
Pandemics don't care if you're bored.
They will win.
And places opened up too fast and without not enough regulations.
Nobody really trusts government at this point. You don't trust the state. You don't trust the feds. I mean, all of us have a lot of respect for Clay Jenkins. He's like fighting an uphill battle, trying to keep science at the forefront, but people keep second guessing him. And it's just terrible. It's just terrible. The population does not trust this government.
Yeah, it's starting with the governor. They don't.
Where's your microphone, Will?
Sorry, I forgot.
Did we just do this whole thing without you having a microphone on?
Yes, we did. It was very close. Kelby? Sorry. Do you think you got it? Okay. All right. All right, second headline. Texas reports the largest single-day increase in coronavirus.
We already did that one.
Okay.
Next headline.
Next headline. Anger, anguish, and calls for change mark George Floyd's memorial in Houston. Wow, that memorial was incredible.
Yeah.
It was incredibly powerful. I thought that I enjoyed Al Sharpton calling Orange Pumpkinhead out on his shit. And I enjoyed him calling law enforcement and out on their shit. And him saying what needed to be said without feeling like he had to be politically correct.
Yep.
No, he's someone who's been fighting the fight a long time, even though he did say something that personally I was offended by. But
why was it?
Well, he had made a comment about which he made a very good point, but it's still, because sometimes we have a large discussion within the people, within the Black community, with being Black enough.
Oh, yeah.
You know, especially if you're biracial, if you're from a different neighborhood, or did you speak a certain way? And he was making a comment about George being a average guy, or him just being a real guy.
Gotcha.
He wasn't a celebrity. Because if he was a celebrity, then they would say that the only reason that people were saying anything is because of his fame. If he was rich, it would be because of his money. And then he made a comment, and he wasn't one of these bourgeoisie Black people either. And I'm like,
you're kind of bougie.
So I took a little offense to that, Miss Al Sharpton. I don't consider myself bourgeois.
You're the bougiest person I know. Like, of all the people I know, you're the bougiest.
Well, he was trying to make a point that we've ignited a movement based on a regular...
Yes, I absolutely agree with, but he could have left out the bougie comment.
That's fair. Yeah. It's not appropriate at a funeral service. Right?
Yes.
I thought it was appropriate. I'm not a bougie either.
You're like the fourth most bougie person.
What's bougie? Bougie? No, I don't dress like this. He dresses not.
Well, okay. Wait. Okay, first of all, to me, bourgeoisie is a person who puts on airs, who pretends to be something that they're not. I'm exactly. You've been in my home.
Yeah, is
you've been around.
Bougie?
That's
like,
for me.
Bougie's like fancy.
Yes, but I think when people use...
We will put the definition of bougie up, and I think it's the French word bourgeois.
Bourgeois. Uh-huh. So but when someone says that to a Black person, they're like, oh, you so bougie.
Yeah, that's true.
Almost like trying to say, you're trying to be all this, and you're trying to be all that. I am all of that. So I'm not trying to be anything. I wake up like
this.
I go to sleep like this.
It's taken that time, but the original bourgeois was you're right.
Yes.
When people call me bougie, they're not saying that. They're just saying, oh, man, I can't believe you spent money on that.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, why do you
think the word, as most words do, has evolved.
Yes.
Okay. Good.
So anyways, Lots of protests have been going on around the state of Texas, and they have actually started impacting change in places like Austin, Texas, and Dallas, Texas. Real conversations are being made about funding of police departments. Houston, opposite happened.
Yeah, I know, but they're conversations.
Yeah, but it's sparking a lot of dialogue that's important. I hope that dialogue translates to action.
I just am so amazed that it's taken us this long to start talking about police budgets. For some reason, I'm like, I mean, I worked in D.C. and I worked at state government level on funding issues. And I don't know, even I'm just shocked that we haven't taken a look at people's budgets on how much the police budget is of a city until now. Like, what were we thinking?
Well, because for politicians, it's always the solution. Increase, but kept your community safe.
Well,
increased spending.
Yeah, it's the federal government. Oh, we got to keep America safe, so they spend $1 billion on a plane, and then that never goes anywhere, and then they discriminate against Black people while they're doing it. I mean, we all need to realize that budgets, as Joe Biden says, budgets are about values.
Yeah,
and when we give all this money to police departments, and we have people living on the street in Dallas, Texas, and have one of the most segregated cities, and people of color not having the same reading levels as others, and prison pipeline from our schools. I mean, that's about values. So yeah. Get these police budgets need to be looked at.
I agree.
All right. Next headline, George W. Bush won't support Donald Trump's reelection, report says.
So George W. Bush looks like he won't be supporting, but immediately after this report came out, his nephew, son of Jeb Bush, George P. Bush, George Prescott Bush, who is the land commissioner in Texas, he came out very full-throated to let everyone know he will be endorsing President Trump and will be doing whatever he can to help him win.
Isn't he a Latino?
Yeah. So Jeb Bush's wife is Latina.
Yeah, I mean, how can you be a Latino?
All Latinos are not woke. Hello, Marco Rubio.
Well, but
he's just trying to do the party thing.
George P. Bush is someone that has made a very clear effort to stride away from the Bush family in being more extreme. The Bush family has this record of, you know, just light Republican, yeah, like terrible things, but doing it
wars
politely.
And stuff, but they're nice, yeah, to people.
just being war criminals politely. Yeah.
Well, isn't Stephen Miller a descendant of Holocaust survivors? I thought I saw, or Jewish descent. I could have swore I saw some of his relatives on. I'll put a question mark at the end of that, like on Twitter. But I could have swore I saw some of his relatives on television talking about they don't understand how he can have this particular philosophy because of the type of family that he is a descendant of.
Sure, but so George P. Bush is hanging right so that he can, he clearly wants to be governor. Yes. Is kind of what's happening. Yes. He wants to be governor, and he thinks that hanging right's his path there. I hope he's right.
I wish him and Dan Patrick would just fight it out.
Well, I'm going to say this here because so many times I've said things that I've been right. I'm going to say this now. Watch when Orange Pumpkinhead loses in November. How many Republicans and how many supporters say, oh, no, I never supported him. Yeah. Oh, no, not me. Oh, no, that's not what you heard. Oh, no, that's not what you saw. Oh, no. Watch and see how that happens. But guess what? We have you all on tape.
We got the receipts.
All right, next headline. Harris County GOP chair-elect Keith Nielsen resigns after sharing racist Facebook posts juxtaposing an MLK quote with a banana.
So Republicans
had a bad week for these.
Republicans in Texas have had a very bad week. A dozen Republican county chairs, actually, I think it was 11 county chairs and the agriculture commissioner, Sid Miller. They all were found to have tweeted either racist tweets around George Floyd's murder by the state or have tweeted conspiracy theories about how George Soros and globalists, which is a key word for those of you who don't know, for Jewish folks are funding the protests and just crazy conspiracy theories.
They always
bullshit.
Blame the Jews about the blacks.
They always do.
They do. It's the history of our country.
Yeah. But they weren't even here at the beginning of all of this.
No, but you mean
full disclosure, Orange Pumpkin here wasn't, his family wasn't here either.
Yeah, he's
while he's talking about Confederate's monument. You weren't here, boo boo. Can you please send me name of what relative you have that is fought in any American war? World War II?
Well, that's not a requirement to be president.
World War I?
The Revolution?
The Revolutionary War?
So,
no, but if you're going to give these comments about these statues and these monuments are talking about our heritage, whose heritage? It's not his.
Yeah, that's fair. It's certainly.
He says our.
But on topic, these Republicans are all under fire. That the incoming chair of the Republican Party for Harris County, which is Houston, he has stepped aside and said he will not assume that role. The others have not. So the Republicans are on a mission to try to root out the racists, which is going to be real rough because it's an entire hen house.
Yeah,
root out the racists.
Well, I guess that goes back. It takes me full circle. I guess if you walk like a racist and talk like a racist,
yeah,
you're probably a racist. Yeah. And just so you guys know, I want all of you guys to know out there, if you wear one of those stupid red Make America Great Again, you see, change the cap to white now, Make America Great Again hats, that to people of color, and
it's an assault.
That is a Ku Klux Klan hood. That's what we see. So you may think that you're putting on a look. We see a Ku Klux Klan hood.
Yep. Well, the difference is Donald Trump's made it where they don't have to cover their face, right?
Yeah. They don't. But
I mean, that's the that's the thing. It is a Klan hood, just you don't have to cover the face.
But you know, I will tell you this. I've been living in Dallas for 2 years now, and I have never seen anyone with that hat on, ever.
Oh, I have.
Well, I live in a very nice part of Dallas.
Obviously, you don't know. All right, next headline. Donald Trump cautions against falsely labeling racists while in Dallas to talk about George Floyd. So he was here yesterday.
Imagine George Floyd's death and your response to it. And the number one thing that you want to address with people in your first public appearance since is, guys, don't start labeling people racist, okay?
Spoken like a true racist.
What did he say? He said, this is Trump's statement. We have to work together to confront bigotry and prejudice wherever they appear, but we'll make no progress and heal no wounds by falsely labeling tens of millions of decent Americans as racists or bigots, Trump said. We have to get everybody together.
Well, I do think that he made a very good point. Falsely labeling. We're not falsely labeling these people as racist. They are
racist. Posting like racist. And acting racist.
And I really would like, once again, Orange Pumpkin Head, I have never used the word. The last president that we've had in this country to me was Barack Obama. And until somebody else comes in, I will not use president in front of. That's just me.
I think people forget that Trump, remember the whole time when we had Obama as president, he found out how powerful it was to be a racist when he was talking about the birther issue. Well, he has a long history. When he was doing the birther issue, that was racism.
He has not said, he has not apologized to Obama. He has not apologized to the Central Park Five. He has not apologized to Colin Kaepernick. So I'm sorry, you cannot keep doing racist things and then not apologize or not make amends for what you've done and then not be a racist. Excuse me, hello?
Well, that, and I think a really important thing that's arisen out of all of this is the idea that it's not enough to just not be racist, that you have to be vehemently anti-racist. And you know, I've always been pretty loud and vocal about it to a point where a lot of people that are racist just don't want to be friends with me, and that's fine. I'm cool with that. And I think that as society, we're getting to that point where everyone's acting like that, and that's fine.
Well, most of the people under 30, like, you know, when I see my son and his friends and everything, I mean, this is just, they can't believe it. Like, they've grown up in a world, the under 30s, where it's just not acceptable. It's people in my generation that they just, that was how they were raised and that's what they think.
And it's a reality that millennials and Gen Z, we're going to get our way on this, guys. It's a matter of, are we going to get it now? Or like, and that's what we're fighting to do? Or are we going to have to wait until the older generation of folks die off? I'm not saying I want older generation of folks to die off. What I'm saying is that when they do, we are going to get our way. So why don't you just let us have our way on it? Because we're going to get it anyways, exactly. And it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And think, I mean, I live in a very ooshy-pooshy area of Dallas, which is probably 99.8% Caucasian. But I have neighbors who have Black Lives Matter signs in front of their homes. Mm-hmm. And one of them has a sign that says Black Lives Matter. And right next to it says, I can't believe we're still dealing with this crap.
Yeah.
And so when I saw them, I said, if you think you can't believe we're still dealing with this crap, girl, think how I feel. Yeah.
Another thing that's really important to bring up on this particular news story is that while Trump was in Dallas, he had a meeting on with black folks in town. I don't even want to call them black leaders because they aren't black leaders in the community.
They're just leaders.
He found some black folks that like him and put them at the table as if they speak on behalf of the community. People that he did not include in the discussion on criminal justice reform or police reform.
Sheriff.
The head of the sheriff.
Police chief. DA, all three black folks in Dallas weren't even invited to the discussion.
And elected officials as well. I think Democratic congressmen. And he didn't want anybody there that would represent progress.
So he met in a church, right? Gateway or one of the churches? And were there any people of color in that church?
I didn't see the crowd.
I saw a photo. It didn't look very colorful.
Yeah. Well, I don't. I'm going to say this, and I don't. First of all, when Joe Biden made the comment that if you support him, you're not. I think I'm paraphrasing. Maybe he said a little bit differently.
I think he said you ain't black.
I'm sorry. I don't usually use that. Ain't that's you guys have words here in Texas that ain't y'all, but I. I personally didn't think he should have taken it back. I'm going to say this as a person of color, a black person in the United States of America. If you are a black person supporting Donald Trump, you ain't black. I don't know what you are. I don't know what you're on. I don't know what you're doing, but
I think you're right.
I feel so funny saying that word.
I'm going to follow you there.
Yes, no, you're
if
not.
You're a woman in the United States of America, and you're supporting Donald Trump. You're not a woman.
You're not a woman.
All right, there we go.
If you're a white guy in America, and you're supporting Donald Trump, you ain't white. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I think we pretty much almost covered everybody except the
law.
Except the log cabin Republicans. Well, they're a whole nother breed, but I won't be invited to any of their parties anyway.
Well, I think this is really important. It happened here in Texas, and it is symbolic of everything that this president has done, where he treats people of color and women as if they're tokens that to be paraded out at his convenience instead of actually tailoring his ideas and his policy and his plans in a fashion that actually benefits those communities.
Right. Yeah. Right. Not having Renee Hall there.
Who's
remarkably apolitical.
Yeah. I mean, that's a huge slap in the face to the city of Dallas and the people of color
or the mayor of Dallas is a black man.
Also, get the fuck out of my town.
Yeah.
You're not welcome here.
Yeah, was the mayor there? I didn't hear.
Fucking Donald Trump. Get the fuck out of our town. No one wants you here. Go to the places where they want you. Go to Rusk. Why don't you spend all your time out in Rusk, Texas? They like you there. You're not allowed in our airports anymore. You aren't allowed in our roads. I'm tired of paying for your protection. Go where they want you. We don't want you here. Go the fuck away.
And I know a lot of people. I have a lot of people, clients in Tulsa. And they are devastated. These are even white clients are devastated that he's having a rally in their city. They have worked so hard to make Tulsa a world-class city that people want to visit. And this is going to take them back almost 100 years by having a Ku Klux Klan rally. Because that's pretty much what it's going to be in their city.
So disrespectful.
It's huge, and these people in Tulsa are so nice.
Yes, they are.
And I do believe he's going to be met by major protests.
I do too.
And I think he's going to be met with all of the businesses there having to board up before he gets there. So downtown businesses and all of the ones in the other surrounding areas are all going to be boarded up. So he's going to arrive to a city that's been boarded up because of him.
Yes. It's so unfair to that city.
Yeah, it is unfair.
The Grand Wizard of the United States, Donald Trump. Glad he's doing this tour in the middle of an international pandemic to stoke tension, even more tension in race relations.
Yes.
Really excited about it. Yeah.
And I know, and I would like to say this to Melania, because girl, I love, because it came out today on the news.
I saw it.
That she was redoing her prenuptial. That's why she took a while.
Did you see that?
I know.
Well, hang on. Before you say this.
I didn't.
For people who aren't familiar, there was a notification that came out today that that a guy that's writing a book on Melania put out an early release of it, and it was found that when Melania was living in New York and not living in D.C., and they, what she was actually doing was using moving to D.C. as a bargaining chip in renegotiating her prenup with the President of the United States.
Yes. I am, because I know a lot of Melania. You know, I'm from Miami, so I know a whole lot of Melanias. And trust me, they just want to be able to come here and go shopping and carry their beautiful Birkin bags and go to spas and lounges and hang out with all of their friends. And they didn't sign up for this. She did not sign up for this. And so, I mean, and now she has so much hate geared towards her.
Oh,
as well, and she does try to stay out of
the book actually says, like, it's coming out that all of that ire directed towards her belongs there.
Oh, I believe
the point of it was it's saying that, like, she is exactly like Donald Trump in that, like, if you look at the stories she's told in her life, she lies about her background. Right. She doesn't forge real relationships with people. They're only, like, for personal benefit. And then she moves
one-sided.
On. Her friends from, like, Slovenia say they never heard from her again. Her friends from New York after she moved to D.C. never hear from her again.
She's an opportunist.
Yeah.
She sounds like all the ladies I know of a certain class in Miami.
All right. Last headline. Monday. Is your deadline to register to vote in the Texas primary runoff, which is going to be on July 14th. So we need everybody who's not registered to register, and everybody needs to vote. Those are important races. All right. And that was Hit the Headlines.
When we come back, we will have County Commissioner candidate Delia Parker Mims in Denton County. She's going to join us. And after that, we will have Dr. Pritesh Gandhi from Texas's 10th Congressional District. He will be joining us today. Really great interview, so stick around. Welcome back to Pod Bless Texas. With us today is a very special guest. He's a very good friend of mine and Lil's, and soon to be great friend of Lorenzo Boutram Hubbard. Our good friend who's running for county commissioner in Denton County in Precinct 3, Delia Parker Mims.
Welcome, welcome.
Hey, thank you. Nice to see y'all. Everybody's looking lovely today.
You are too. And I just want to say, you know, this has been long in the making. We have been trying to get you on the podcast, and it has been our fault. It has been our fault that it hasn't happened. But this week, with the removal of the Confederate statue in Denton County, we thought this would be the best time for us to be able to have you on and talk about why county commissioners' races are so freaking important.
That is
and
so
why
true.
You're running and who you are, and get our folks to know who you are.
So who are you, Delia Parker Mims?
Who am I? No. Thank you, guys. I'm so excited that you guys have finally got me on your show. I'm a big fan of both of you guys. You have an awesome show.
Thank you.
I am Delia Parker Mims. I'm a Denton County Commissioner in District 3. That is in Louisville, a little bit of Flower Mound, Highland Village, Hickory Creek, and Lake Dallas. I am an attorney. I've been an attorney for 25 years. I went to SMU as well as Mr. Lerner. You know how that is. And I've been practicing in the area. And I am a family attorney. I do a lot of juveniles with mental health. And that is a big part of why I'm running, because a lot of the juveniles I represent have mental health issues. And we're dealing with their mental health in the criminal process, and I can't stand that. And that's something that commissioners that want to touch can actually touch. So I've been doing that for a long time. And I work with just regular families and people, seniors that have housing insecurity. I do all kinds of, I don't even really make money off of seniors, and children are kind of my passion. But there's a lot of that in our District 3, is seniors who have to choose between electricity and their and their medication. And I work with those people on a daily basis, and mothers who are just working hard and trying to make it go. So that's who I am. And after 25 years of working with that type of population, I've decided that it's time to transfer that to work on a broader scale and do that from the commissioner's position.
That's amazing. It's amazing. And county commissioners, for people who aren't familiar, it's like a city council for a county, right? There are in Texas, there are four commissioners in every county and a county judge. The county judge presides over it like a mayor would. And so in this situation, you would be running to be a Democrat that would serve on a Denton County Commissioner court, which made a big decision this week. And the decision they made was to take down a Confederate statue where there has been longstanding fights to get that removed. But you're running against someone who actually voted against removal. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. Well, a longstanding Republican. So breaking through that red wall would be amazing. It's been a red wall for 20, 30 years, which means they look at things a certain way. And it's time that we all had a seat at the table. And that Confederacy issue, that monument, for 20 years, there's been a fellow in Denton named Willie Hutzbeth, and people kind of know him, who's been fighting to get that monument down, that Confederate monument, no matter how disrespectful they treated him. And let me be clear, every single person on that commissioner's court treated him disrespectfully when he would go in there week after week and say that monument is hurtful to him and it represents slavery and all kinds of ugliness that we just don't need sitting on the lawns of our justice. And so they've made it clear they were certainly not going to bring it down. And the incumbent that I'm running against, she was actually the one that they handpicked for whatever reason to go around the county and to try to say that we're going to keep it up and let's just try to put context in it. Let's put context.
Let's be honest, Delia, you know exactly why they picked her.
Well, yeah, her sitting county commissioner is Bobby Mitchell, who is an African-American female
Republican
that at one point was the mayor of Louisville that I've known in my own career when I was a lawyer in Denton County. And and I wouldn't call her progressive or an activist.
No. She's very much a Republican. So yeah. She did not advocate to move that symbol until this past week. And the thing about it is, they didn't move it because they've come to some new consciousness about what it represents. They actually moved it, and their rhetoric is that the statue itself is in danger from all the peaceful protesting. So the rhetoric itself is racist, okay? And so that allows them to assuage their base and say, well, we've got to move it because it's in danger, because they know times are changing. But it gave them an out. But then they didn't use it to say that we believe in inclusiveness and a culture of moving forward with opportunity for everyone. They said, y'all fools out there marching may danger the statue, so we're going to take it down.
That is so infuriating.
But
that
the thing
is
that
the worst. That really is the worst.
The thing that kind of sounds a little suspicious with that is the way that they worded it sounds like it could go back up.
Well, I think they know that times are changing, right? So they haven't said when they're going to move it. They haven't said what they're going to do with it. And there was some type of discussion that maybe they would have. Okay, are you ready to get your seatbelt on? They would have it on a traveling truck to go from school to school, because without seeing this monument, folks ain't going to know nothing about the Confederacy. So
there's nothing Republicans love more than antique roadshow. What the hell?
Oh my God. That's exactly what it is, an antique roadshow.
They're going to put that on a travel trailer, but not the United States Constitution or the Bill of Rights.
I don't know if they'll be able to borrow the Constitution.
No, that's just terrible.
Yeah, because it's so necessary to show the black and white drinking fountains that are attached to that monument.
When we finally are able to elect you to the commissioner's court in November, what are going to be the largest projects that you want to start working on for the people of Denton County?
Well, first of all, I think people of Denton County need to realize that commissioners actually can do something. Yeah, so a lot of people don't know anything about commissioners because ours like to go around and say, well, we keep the tax rate low. And that's because they don't do anything. And that literally is all that they do. But if you look at other commissioners' counties, you can reach beyond roads and bridges. And so some of the things I want to do is, number one, I want to open up Denton County so that we have voting centers. How many people really love standing in line on election day only to find out that you're in the wrong precinct after 2 hours and then you have to go someplace else?
Yep.
Okay. Right.
So the legislature has already said we can have voting centers, and that's what commissioners do. We can't change the law, but we have to enact what the legislatures do, right? So the legislature already gives us the right to have voting centers. In Denton County, we don't have them. They'll tell you, well, it's because we don't have the right voting machines. Well, that's because they chose not to contact the only freaking Democratic House District's person that we have, Michelle Beckley, and tell them to put our voting machines on that list of approved voting centers. With a Democratic like myself on the at the table, we would all have voting centers. And everybody ought to want that, regardless of whether you're Republican or Democrat.
Right.
So that's like plus, I mean, you have two major universities in that area that, I mean, Denton County is one of the fastest growing counties. I mean, the fact that we haven't had any diversity of thought there for my entire law practice and my for forever, 50 years.
And for folks who aren't familiar, it's University of North Texas and Texas Women's University.
Then a huge community college area. And then you have all the fast growing of Flower Mound and Highland Village and Louisville. It's just
going to say it. You're from Louis. I'm from Miami originally. I've only been here. This is 2 years now. And as a transplant to Dallas, someone new here, when I hear about Louisville and people of color make certain comments about Denton, Louisville, they're like, child, be careful, please. You're going out this way. So, I mean, for me as an outsider, someone just coming here, you have certain areas of even the Dallas or surrounding Dallas area that do not have a good reputation with people of color.
Yeah. You're exactly right. When I was a much younger attorney, I just look good, but I've been practicing law for a long time. I was a much younger attorney, you're exactly right. People would be like, why the hell are you in Denton County? Or why do you live in Denton? What is wrong? You know, it's true. So it does have that image, and that monument certainly did not help any of those issues.
Well, you can find, when I worked in Denton County, I was an attorney, and at one time I was the only, I wouldn't call myself Spanish speaking at this point in my life, but at that time I spoke Spanish, and I was the only, here I was, a very young attorney, Spanish speaking, and they didn't know what to do with the Spanish speaking population that was moving in there, and they used me. This is why I know how I'm. Her seat's so important, and we need to get her to be an elected official. At that time, anybody that was Spanish-speaking, tons of people were, that got involved in the criminal justice system in Denton County, they didn't want to pay for a translator. So they would just hire me to be the translator and the attorney and just put us all in. And I was just thinking,
lump you all up.
This violates so many things. So that in my second experience in Denton County, I actually grew up part of my life there. I worked in the jail in Denton County, and I didn't go to school with a bunch of black people because I grew up in Little Elm, Texas. When I went to the jail to work, when I was getting my master's, I had no idea that the color piece, I mean, it was all brown and people, like the entire jail population, period. This was in the late 80s, and I questioned that, and then I saw just systematic racism.
And that's another thing
that's still there.
That's another thing I want to address, Lillian, as a commissioner, and it could be more powerful coming from that position, is the school to prison pipeline. Okay. Because you have the black and brown populations that are getting kicked out of school or they may commit a misdemeanor. They may steal a package off of someone's desk. Then they have a mental health issue, so they're in school and they get suspended. Well, that's a violation of probation, so now you've got the criminal court system taking them out of their homes. Okay, it's not my opinion. You can look up and see, especially in the southern states, it goes up by numbers of how brown and black kids are suspended more, are sent to ISS more, and that relationship between having a disability and being in the criminal court system is related. So I think there's a task force that needs to address that. And like I said before, that was one of the main reasons that is empowering me to want to run, because we've got to address that within our school system and within our criminal court system. We shouldn't be treating mental health in the criminal system, and we've got to address that disparity that we have with those populations.
So at the top of the ticket, with an anti-Trump referendum that we think will happen in a place like Denton County, where we have, you know, a good candidate for the congressional seat out there, also the female,
Carol Iannuzzi,
have to do a runoff. Yeah, and then you've got, so people need to vote all the way down. That's how.
Oh my goodness! So we've got to start the campaign. Don't stop at the top, because see, Republicans, they have a knee jerk reaction, but here's the problem: they're just not smart. So they got a knee jerk reaction. They got upset because Beto got everybody excited, and then they decided, ooh, we better get rid of straight ticket voting. So a lot of people don't realize you got to literally go in and click every single candidate now. I think that's going to be to my benefit, given the direction of my county. And I believe anybody that researches me and my opponent, I'm going to get their vote. But you have to, everybody now has to vote every single candidate. So we've got to educate people. Don't stop at the top. Don't think I'm voting for Biden to get rid of that piece in Washington, which is important. You got to keep going down, because the closer the position is to you, the more it impacts your life. And I may very well be the last race on the ballot, but I am the most important when it comes to what happens to everybody in their everyday life.
You are 100% right. And we're just tickled that you took time out to come on the show today. If people were inspired by you today, or they want to help a candidate that's here in Texas working their ass off to make a real difference, where can they go to follow you and help?
They can go to, and it's really, really complicated, okay? VoteDeliaParkerMims.com. Vote Delia Parker Mims. That's my name. Vote is what I need you to do. VoteDeliaParkerMims.com. That is my website. It has my link on it. And one thing I want to leave you guys with, because I know you've got to move forward, is that this is actually a winnable race. We've been talking about the dynamics of this area, but I'm like in the top noble races in Denton County. We know we already flipped HD 65. That encompasses my county. We know that 64, we Beto already won 64. That encompasses my county. And we know that in my specific race, Beto got 46% of the vote. That means it's a toss-up. And right now, people are looking for government that is responsive. So what I'd like to tell people is, you want smart, responsive leadership. Doesn't matter what your party is, but we're going to go out and get those Democrats, and we're going to get those people who know that it's time to move forward. All they got to do is go to VoteDeliaParkerMims.com, and we need your money. If you can flip Denton, if we flip Denton, we flip Texas. So that ought to encourage everybody.
Well, and another thing that I like to remind people of, as someone who's run for city council before, when you have these races down ballot that have much smaller populations inside of them, the help that you give them is so much greater.
It's
like you could give, you know, $50 to Joe Biden, which is great and awesome. Joe Biden is not going to be able to maximize that $50 as much as someone like Delia Parker Mims, who's running in a much smaller district.
Right. So everybody send Delia $50, $100, $50.
$6 million.
Just to turn Texas blue.
If all of our listeners sent $50 to $100, she'd have enough for a very good mailing.
Delia, we love you. We're rooting for you.
We are so rooting
for you. Our friend, Delia Parker Mims, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. All right.
When we come back, we are going to have one of the Democrats that's running for Congress in Texas's 10th congressional district. It'll be Dr. Pritesh Gandhi, so stick around.
Welcome back to Populous Texas. With us today is a candidate from Texas Congressional District 10, Dr. Pritesh Gandhi.
Yay!
Thank you all for having me here.
And he's involved in a runoff on July 14th in order to become the Democratic candidate to oppose Representative Mike McCall.
Boo! Spooky music.
Spooky. thank you for being on.
Happy to be on with you all today. Thank you.
So, campaigning during a pandemic, wonderful or amazing?
You're not giving me a lot of choices here. campaigning during a pandemic. Well, look, it's a double-edged sword for me in the sense that I'm at the clinic every day, right? So in the middle of March and moving into April, I was essentially living at the clinic and then coming home at night to do these Zooms. And so as we're getting closer to July, that ratio has shifted a bit. So now I'm spending a lot more time on Zoom and a less PE, but it's hard to say what's where I'd almost rather be in PPE than be behind a Zoom screen. Yeah. You know, it's you miss the human contact in campaigning. I mean, if you're not able to put, you know, your hand on a shoulder and talk to folks, it's tough, you know. Yeah. So we're doing our best that we can with the Zooms, but we definitely miss the.
From your background, seem like a guy, when you look at your background, that you're like to be out there serving patients. Your story's so compelling. Your relationship with your father and seeing how he treated patients and saw the underserved. Why in the world did you want to run for Congress? You look like pretty well.
You seem like a nice guy. Why would you do this?
You know, I will admit a bit of, I think naive is too strong of a word. Yes, politics is a blood sport, and
it really is. And
I'll tell you that. Look, for me, it was very straightforward what pushed me into politics. I've been involved in advocacy my entire life, right? So 15 years ago, I was working in a landfill on access to clean water and on supplying micronutrients to children. This was internationally. You know, I pivoted after that. I actually went back to school to get my public health degree. Who knew 15 years ago that it would matter to have your public health degree? But here we are. That's good. And really dedicated my adult life to trying to understand the systems that produce the outcomes that they do, right? So for all of us who are advocates or activists, we fight these outcomes of systems that are designed to produce those outcomes, right? And so it's not a surprise to me that gun violence is an issue. Of course it is. Look at the system that we're working in, right? It's not a surprise that we're having a hard time with this pandemic, or we're having issues with families being separated at the border. Look at these systems. So, you know, I've agitated within these confines for a number of years, but ultimately, when the president was elected, I started having patients, children, that would come in, often unaccompanied, because they were afraid, their parents were afraid to take public transportation or to drive, and these children were going, getting groceries alone, they were doing their daily activities alone, and the trauma was so great. The burden on these kids was so great. And you can only be in exam rooms hearing these stories, seeing these children cry, seeing trauma happen as a instrument of the state when you say enough, enough, enough. And so pushed on that front. And then simultaneously in the months after the president took office, he pushed forth this travel ban. And I found myself at the airport that day behind a microphone. I said, look, this president or this party, no one is going to tell me or my children that we don't belong here. I am more aware of what I look like and my skin color now and in these last 4 years than I have ever been in my entire life. I'm born and raised in Houston. I'm a Texan.
Hello. Welcome to my world.
Right. You're exactly right. I mean, you know, I took Texas flag with me to Boston, and now these last 4 years, I'm like, where the hell am I? And now I understand. Gosh. So anyhow.
Everything about your background just reeks of an entrepreneurial Houstonian, and yet you're defined by this last 3.5 years as an immigrant or a black person or someone who doesn't have status. And it's just crazy that we're now defining ourselves by tribes versus citizenry.
I think it's one of these things that even as a Indian American and dealing with a whole host of things growing up, right? Like if I had a nickel for every time someone told me to go back to where you come from, or You know, where are you really from? All these normal microaggressions you get being a person of color in this country. There is still so much to be learned from the experience of the Black community in this country. You know, the privilege I have still as an Indian American is that while I may be looked at as other, I may be looked at as foreign, as not belonging here in our country, I am not looked at as subhuman. And there's a distinction. Damn, it is a sorry state of affairs that we find ourselves in now when we even have to say things like that. And so, it is a rude awakening that we're in now, but I think a call to action for children of immigrants, for people of color, to not just be allies in this, this recognition or this fight for recognition of our collective humanity, but to be patriots alongside with Black Americans as we fight for basic decency and dignity. There's a difference here.
So Donald Trump created your opportunity here for running for office.
Donald Trump gave me no choice, right? Like, right. I have a voice. I'm not afraid to use it. I always tell folks that, you know, when I was young, I had a severe stutter. Every year I speak at this camp. There's the Lang Stuttering Institute here. It's one of the only major stuttering institutes in the country, hosted by University of Texas. They do a summer camp for children who stutter. I stuttered my entire life. What you all don't know now listening to me is that I'm switching words all the time, consistently. And it took decades of speech therapy for me to get to a point where I can communicate. But I always told myself when I was young, and I've said the story before, that if I ever found my voice, I'd spend the rest of my life fighting for those that don't have it. It is personal. It is personal to me. And when the president was elected, I know I've got a voice, and I know how to use it effectively. And I'll be damned if I'm not going to use this voice to fight for folks that the president's pushing into the.
You know, what I find particularly interesting about this particular election cycle is that we have a lot of doctors that have stepped up to run on the Democratic ticket this year. It's hard to get people that are doctors to run because they're professionals that really don't want to get drug into all this, number one. Number two, they'll make a whole lot more money not being in Congress as long as they're not corrupt, right? But this year, what we found, our friend of the podcast, Dr. Carolyn Salter, has come on. You, Dr. Edie Mann. I mean, just here in Texas, we have a lot of doctors that are running. And then we have now coincidentally found ourselves in the middle of an international pandemic, which we would have never imagined to have happened. Do you see this pandemic as something that you, as a doctor, would be able to provide better legislation for than your average member of Congress, Chris?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that what this pandemic is demonstrating is the importance of having diversity in Washington, diversity by race and by ethnicity, and diversity of professional experience, right? And this is not a knock, it's not a knock on attorneys. It's not a knock on others that make up the plurality of members of Congress. But the reality is that in 2018, when the president decided to sack the member of the National Security Council that was in charge of pandemic preparedness, there was a committee hearing in the weeks after, and Secretary of State Pompeo was being questioned during that hearing. And out of all the members on that committee, the only person that questioned Secretary Pompeo about the recent firing of this gentleman who was supposed to be heading our pandemic response was Dr. Ami Bera, a physician from California, who said, "Hey, who's going to be in charge if a pandemic is barreling our way?" And so it matters to have diversity of professional experience in Washington. And we're seeing this now, right? Like, we're in the middle of a pandemic. I am part of the leadership of a nonprofit health clinic in East Austin. We serve about 20,000 uninsured and underinsured Central Texans. And I'm lucky to be a part of leaders, co-leaders, who also have their master's in public health, who are seeing patients. And we can formulate plans and think about supply chains and think about what is needed to be effective. And if we had more folks like this in charge, we would be climbing out of this a lot sooner. I mean, look, thousands of Americans are dead. We're estimating up to 170 or 180,000 Americans total by the September or October, maybe end of October. And we're throwing in the towel. I mean, you get this sense that we're losing focus as a country, and we're throwing in the towel. And we're saying, you know what? Screw it. Thousands of Americans are going to die. Nothing we can do about it. Hey, guess what? Gun violence is a problem. Thousands of Americans die from that too. Oh, well, it's too damn complicated. We're not going to deal with it. You know, too complicated. We're not going to deal with it. And what we're, the American political way over the last two decades has been to say, screw it. Too complicated. Let people die. You know, freedom and liberty. And no sense on being able to think critically about evidence, about evidence-guided interventions that can actually improve issues. No one plays the long game, and it's frustrating.
Well, I have a question for you. Being a medical professional, and one thing that you never hear people talk about, we have crossed the number of 2 million people who have actually tested positive. Of that 2 million, there have been a very high number of people who have been hospitalized. And what I have heard is that these people who have been hospitalized are not the same once they come out. Their lung capacity is not the same. Their body, and no one is talking about the walking injured, the walking incapacitated, the walking handicapped. How many of these people are now considered handicapped or considered dysfunctional in some way because the things that they were able to do before, they no longer can do?
You're exactly right. This isn't a headline. And in fact, I've been on national television a few times over the last few weeks talking about this pandemic, and I've never talked about this. And thank you for bringing it up. People leave the hospital, not always, but a significant percentage of patients post-COVID leave their hospitalizations with not just reduced lung capacity, as you're saying, but with other neurologic effects from being intubated for so long, being on the ventilator for so long. There are some other diseases that are co-mingle with coronavirus. And there is a concern that not just from a monetary perspective, because that's real too, right? We've got now hundreds of Americans that are going to require physical therapy and occupational therapy and meetings with specialists and others. But the emotional toll on patients, Americans, their caregivers, the very real need to change their way of life because they just can't breathe in air like they used to, is very real. And it is a cost of this pandemic, the emotional cost and the very real financial cost that just isn't being quantified or qualified in any way, shape, or form. And I think,
turns,
you know,
out
just to that point, we're also not talking about the emotional toll on our children, right? Who are not socializing with their friends, who are not in school, who are worried now about playing with their friend next door and their, you know, a parent saying, hey, you got to stay 6 feet away. I mean, real concerns.
Turns out breathing, a pretty important part of the human condition.
Yeah.
So recently as yesterday, your campaign put out a plan for police reforms. We have seen massive protests in every state around this country, in a call for action in a subject that's been very delayed in that much needed action. What do those police reforms entail for you, and how will that solve the problem that Black Americans are facing today?
Yeah,
and brown.
Black and brown. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what I'll first say is, we are coming into this conversation with hat in hand, and I don't think our leaders say this often enough. I don't know all the answers. I know how to listen. I had part of this story from before when I was telling you about being a lifelong stutterer is that when you're young and you stutter so bad you can't talk, you end up listening a hell of a lot. You end up having full conversations with people just by being in the room and being present. You realize that, frankly, you can communicate a hell of a lot more if you don't say anything to begin with. And so we are in listening mode right now. And the reform agenda that we put out yesterday, it's not just a reform agenda for policing. It is a social justice and racism reform agenda in policing, housing, education, and healthcare. All of these things are tied together. Let me give you an example. In Travis County, we have a group called MCOT. MCOT is the sort of the mental health crisis team that responds to situations, right? And so the example I gave yesterday was that I once had a patient, young black man, had a mental health issue. I was not able to de-escalate the issue in my clinic. I had to call MCOT. MCOT wasn't available, so police showed up. And then more police showed up. And I was deeply afraid that it was going to end poorly. And then by the very nick of time, MCOT showed up, which was crisis-trained counselors, social workers, psychiatrists, and de-escalated the situation. A few months later, this patient wasn't so lucky. Something else happened. Police showed up, and the patient ended up in jail. And a very bad outcome. Now, when we're talking about reform as it relates to policing, what we're really talking about is the fact that because the social safety net has been gutted in a systemic way over the last decade, police have been, for good or for bad, and I think we'll make the argument here for bad, have been shouldered with the responsibility of having to deal with a whole host of complex social issues that they are just not trained to do. They're not trained to do it. But if you are responding to a domestic violence incident and you are afraid that there may be a gun on site, it's a little tougher to send just a social worker, right? You may have to send police. This is how these issues are interconnected. Because until we have meaningful reform on gun violence in our country, it's hard to have meaningful reform in policing. Until we have meaningful reform in healthcare, it's hard to see meaningful reform happening in housing. We have got to integrate these conversations because racism infects each and every one of our major institutions, and we are trying to deal with it in their own silos, and that's hard. And so this reform agenda speaks to that. Now, we've released part one on policing, which leans in heavy on evidence-driven strategies in public health literature, violence interruption programs, civilian emergency responders, getting rid of these ridiculous things like chokeholds and stop and frisk and other things like that. But again, this is just part one of what is going to be a multidisciplinary approach to how we deal with social justice in our country. But we're going to have to work and break out of ours. There's no way to do this.
I think that one of the other things, I used to be a law enforcement officer. I don't know if you were part of that discussion, you heard that part. But I think that one of the things that also should be done, because you hear a huge discussion going on right now about how easy it is for an officer to be fired from one jurisdiction and just go get a job in another city. I think officers should be licensed, just like a lawyer's license, a doctor's license. You should be licensed. And if you are fired and you lose your license, you no longer can get a job in another city or state because you now no longer have a law enforcement license. Just like we have a CCW, a permit to carry a gun. Mm-hmm. If you are fired from a department for mental health reasons, you lose your right to be able to get a CCW. Even after you leave and you have your pension and you try to apply for a CCW, depending on why you left the police department, you can now not apply for a CCW, don't qualify. Mm. I think that police officers, there should be one rule and guidebook for police officers federally on how they're trained. And those police officers, when they graduate from the police academy, receive a license to be a law enforcement officer.
That's an interesting thought.
I think you're exactly right on this notion of how important it is to have standardization in high risk professions, right? Like when we hire new physicians at our clinic, we tap into the national database that allows us to see every action that a state board has taken on that physician. It allows us to see that they've met certain national criteria. And you know that at baseline, at least what you're getting. And if I were to move from Texas to wherever, at that new job, they'd be able to see any actions that the State Board of Medicine here had to take. Now, they haven't, thankfully, but they'd be able to see that. I think you're right. I think we have to standardize. And I think to your point, that's a really good one. Thank you for bringing it up.
So tell us, Doctor, when your primary, March 3rd, when was it March 3rd, and the runoff's July 14th, mm-hmm. First, we have a lot of listeners across the state. Where is your district and how can people help get you elected?
Yeah, so the district runs from northwest Houston all the way to northwest Austin. It is a
beast,
gerrymandered district. It's hilarious, really. I mean, look, this used to be the 10th district is a historical district. It was the district of President LBJ, was a Democratic district all the way until it was gerrymandered away. And now you've got sort of Tech Austin. You've got a rural part in the middle, which actually makes up the bulk of the geography of the district. And then you've got Northwest Houston. So it's a heck of a district. And there are two big ways that folks can help us out in this race and then onwards as we move into the general. One is to get involved. We have phone banks that happen every day all across the state of Texas. Actually, we have phone banks that happen all across the country. We've got hundreds of volunteers that are making phone calls. This is the joy of campaigning in the COVID world, is that we can't knock on doors anymore. You can't drop off lit at folks' home, but you can get on the phone and talk to somebody. And so so that's one big way. You can head to our website, www.gandhifortexas.com, and sign up to volunteer there. The other big way, of course, is that running these kinds of campaigns, it ain't cheap. You know, I'm a doctor at a nonprofit clinic. I've got three young daughters at home and $250,000 of medical school debt. And I'm running against the Speaker of Congress. And so a little bit of a mismatch here. And so if you're inspired by anything that you've heard today, head over to our website and chip in a couple of bucks. It matters to us to be able to compete at the field level in every county in this district, 9 counties. We want field staff in every county. All of our employees are W-2 employees. We want to be able to treat our employees with dignity and respect. And so we need the cash to be able to do that. And so folks can, of course, support us in that way as well. And of course, spread the word. Find us on Twitter, share our work. All that matters.
Great.
Can I ask one last question?
Yeah.
This might be my last question. I don't know. But for going to vote Democrat, no matter what, for Republicans who have some sense and who will cross over and vote Democrat, what separates, if you had to name just two things that separates you from Mr. Siegel and why people should vote for you? Because I study both of your platforms and I did see some differences, obviously, and I really like you. You're really nice. So, but if there were two differences that you are two key points that you wanted, or points of differences that you wanted to touch on, why people should support you, what would they be?
Yeah, I want to, before I answer that question, I want to put the disclaimer out here. Here's the disclaimer. I know Mike. I supported Mike in 2018. I went to a couple of his events, and I wanted him to win. He's a good man. He's a good father, a good husband. I wish nothing but the best for Mike. But the stakes are really high this year. And the reason why Planned Parenthood and the Giffords campaign against gun violence and multiple members of Congress and hundreds of volunteers and folks around the country and state and region are supporting me is that we have demonstrated the ability to put together a winning campaign. And when you look at Mr. Siegel's campaign this time around compared to last time around, not much has changed. He was still outraised 2-1, 3-1, 4-1. And if you can't raise the money to hire a field staff in every county in this district, you will not defeat Mike McCall. We won't outraise McCall, but you've got to be able to put the resources together to be able to compete, because it demonstrates to people in Harris County and in the rural parts of this county that you care about them, that you care enough to staff an office there. And to do that, you've got to build coalitions. And so there is a difference there in how we are running our campaign, the operation of our campaign, and our ability to communicate to voters. So if you care about winning, if you care about putting a Democrat in office who is a progressive, who will build coalitions, who cares not about slogans, but about getting shit done, then you vote for me in this race. That's the bottom line, because I don't care. I honestly don't care if you're a Republican, an independent, a Democrat. I don't care what your positions are. What I care about is that you care about your neighbors, you care about your family, and you have enough goodwill to sit around a table and to together build legislation that will improve people's lives. And so there's a distinction there. I think the other distinction, this is probably more in the weeds, but for some of your supporters that are in the weeds here, there is a difference in terms of ideology versus practical experience. What is conceptual for Mike and his campaign is rooted in experience for me. When Mike speaks about gun violence, I look to my work in 2012 after Sandy Hook, starting a group, Doctors Against Gun Violence, and being on the ground fighting this fight and crisscrossing the state, speaking about the importance of legislation that protects children and families. When Mike talks about immigration, I led the country's largest rally of doctors and scientists at the border in Tornillo when they were separating children from their parents. When Mike talks about paid sick leave, I testified at the House on the importance of paid sick leave a year ago on the front lines. When he talks about choice, I was behind a microphone fighting for the need for reproductive access, and I have that conversation every day in exam rooms. So on issue after issue after issue, we've got the receipts. We've got the proof that we've been doing the work for a decade and a half. And I think we caught folks by surprise here in Austin that we did as well as we did. And it's because folks know the work that we've done in the communities. You know, 5 years ago, when I was not thinking about running for politics, if you were to try to look for me on a Friday night, you'd find me at a neighborhood meeting, maybe a Restore Runberg meeting, maybe at a neighborhood association meeting in Manor, maybe knocking on doors in East Austin, talking about the empty Home Depot up the road and what we're going to do about it to preserve the community. That kind of work doesn't make headlines. It ain't pretty. I didn't go to Democratic clubs, but I was fighting for the people that the Democratic Party fights for. And so there are distinctions there. There are distinctions in the kind of campaign we've built. There are distinctions in the experience that we have. And by and large, you know, we're not running an ideological campaign. We're running a campaign that is rooted in people's stories. And I'm not afraid to play the long game here. I think a lot of times people look at the word compromise and incrementalism as dirty words. I think people have had enough of polarization in Washington. We need people who are going to go there and get the work done to improve people's lives.
Dr. Pritesh Gandhi, we appreciate you for taking time out of your schedule to come and join us here on our small podcast, Pod Bless Texas. But you don't get to leave yet. But before you go, you have to play everyone's favorite segment. It's called Obsessed. Obsessed, where each of us are going to talk about one news story from the week, whether it was politics or wasn't, that we've been completely obsessed with. And as always, we have to start this segment with Lillian Salerno. So Lillian, what's something this week you've been completely obsessed with?
Black Lives Matter. And while we're fixing police reform, we should fix the racism in our armed forces. And this week in Congress, it sort of was buried, but there was an OIG report about the racism that they've been trying to fix in the Coast Guard, and just nothing's been done. And then there's just this history on these major institutions in our society where we've allowed this, we keep allowing it. And so when people are saying defund police departments, and whatever your opinion is, we should tie whatever we do into creating opportunities to get rid of these bad actors, because we have so many of them. And let's do that with the Pentagon budget also. as long as they're going to make it, so that we've never had a African-American female fly a F-18, not because we don't have those qualified, but because we pinpoint African-Americans and hold them down in almost every sector of our military. And Donald Trump, in response to that, puts an African-American in charge of the Air Force and thinks he's done, but doesn't create any opportunities for people going up. And we should start talking about defunding the Pentagon on the same levels we're talking about defunding the police departments in this country. That's my obsessed.
All right.
Because it's about over 90% of our budget or something. At the it's massive. And you talk about a city like Houston, where you got a $6 billion budget and a billion of it's going for police, and people are getting their heads around that. Multiply that when we're talking about a federal budget, how little we give to Medicaid, how little we give to environmental issues, how little we give to mental health. And these Pentagon budgets are like this. Let's tie them. Okay, you want your money. Start making it right for African-American people, because you've been holding them down for generations. So that's my obsessed. See, we're real light around here.
Well, very light. This is good.
Gut obsessed. Lorenzo Boutram Hubbard, the gay socialite, the Dallas socialite, the
Brickle
socialite, the $1 million decorator alumnus. What is something this week you've been completely obsessed with?
Well, it's very difficult this week not to be obsessed with something that has to do with Orange Pumpkin Head or Black Lives Matter. But I've been obsessed this week with something. There was a guest who was on CNN. His name is Tim Wise. He's an anti-racism educator. And one of the things that I've been obsessed with, he said, if Black children aren't allowed innocence, then white children don't deserve innocence. And the reason he said that is because someone asked him, at what age should white parents start explaining white privilege to their children? And he said he did it, this is a white man, he said he did it at 6 years old. Because, and then they said, someone asked him, did they think that was too young? And he says, but little Black children have to start learning that young, what it's like to be sexualized, what it's like to deal with the police, what it's like to have to live in the ghetto, what it's like to not have a grocery store, what it's like. We're fucking sick of what it's like. So if we can deal with all of that, you mean to tell me little white kids can't understand or don't deserve to have the conversation of what white privilege is like? I'm sorry. I'm obsessed. And I'm given the platform as a person of color, and I'm a biracial descendant, but I'm given a platform as someone who always has a seat at a table, many times as the only person of color in very affluent places. And I call people out on their bullshit all the time.
Which is my favorite thing about you.
He's seen me do it. So you cannot tell me that you support Black Lives Matter and then take your ass home to your all-white community and not ask, why do no people of color live here? You cannot tell me that you support Black Lives Matter, but then you go back to your office where everybody is white and you don't ask, why are there no people of color working here? You cannot come to a city like Dallas, Texas, and go to bar after bar and restaurant after restaurant in the middle of a major metropolitan city in the United States of America in 2020, and everybody's white and you don't notice? What the hell? I'm sorry, white people have to do more. It is not up to us to do all the heavy lifting. It is now up to white people to say, enough is enough. Where can I make a difference? And I'm going to go out there, even if it's uncomfortable, I'm going to make a change. That's what I'm obsessed about. I'm Lorenzo Boutram Hubbard.
Bravo.
Good obsessed, Lorenzo Boutram Hubbard. Good obsessed.
And I'm going to a wine tasting and I'm going to let their ass have it at 5:30.
That's right.
Dr. Ritesh Gandhi, Democrat who is running for Congress in Texas Congressional District 10, what is something this week you've been completely obsessed with?
It can't be me because you just met me.
Well, I know. I'm obsessed with this show, and I feel like I need to. I want to come and hang out with you. Where can I find you all? I want to come to that wine tasting. So, look, this COVID stuff is on my mind. Texas, this is a really not a good week for our state. We're at our worst that we've been, record hospitalizations. The Texas Medical Center in Houston has had multiple days of increased hospitalizations. In Austin, we've had our highest overall moving average of hospitalizations since we started this pandemic. In my clinic, we've had yesterday was our busiest drive-through testing day since we started this pandemic. As I was saying before, I feel people are just tired of this whole thing, and I feel the government's given up, and thousands of more Americans are going to die. And what I'm obsessed about is this this story that I saw yesterday that Trump put this disclaimer at the bottom of his invitations to his rallies that says, oh, by the way, if you come to this rally, it's not my fault if you get COVID. I don't want you all wearing masks. And I'm going to continue to deny that coronavirus is a real thing and that it's made up by these public health leftist progressive physicians and public health practitioners. But, oh, by the way, if you do get sick, not my fault, not my company's fault. It is disgusting. Our president is just, I have run out of adjectives. You know, as we were saying before, when you're a lifelong stutterer like myself, you end up substituting words all the time. So I've got a ton of adjectives that I usually substitute in for. I'm out. I got nothing left to describe the president. Just yeah, silent. Out. Got to vote this man out in November. I'm obsessed about that. I'm obsessed about the fine print. We got to vote this man to our country.
It's such a Donald Trump thing, though, right? To be more concerned with the liability of people contracting COVID than the people that have actually contracted COVID.
No surprise.
Well, I also think that it's either we have to get to one point. Either you're super stupid or you're not super stupid. You can't be both. So he likes to come, I'm the smartest person that you ever heard in the whole world. I know everything. I read every book. I read every newspaper. And you didn't know that about the Tulsa massacre.
Right.
And you didn't know about 300 black people being murdered. You didn't know about Black Wall Street. And you didn't know about the Jacksonville and the number of people that were murdered there on the day that you're having the conviction. Oh, my God. Either pick stupid or intelligent, but you can't have both.
So he doesn't know about Greenwood, but he does know about when the riot starts, the shooting starts.
Oh, yeah,
right? So like he knows a lot about white supremacist history.
This man knows the history. He knows exactly what he is doing.
Absolutely.
Good obsessed, good, Dr. Pratesh Dhani. Good obsessed. My obsessed this week, I had one in mind, but I think I'm about to switch it around. You know, my cross to bear. I'm a martyr, guys.
We know.
My cross to bear is that I am the one liberal who watches NASCAR. I have always been a NASCAR fan. I'm a gun owner. You know, I'm a different kind of Democrat than a lot of people are used to, right? But I've always, since I've been a kid, I've been a big fan of NASCAR. And this week, my friends at NASCAR, have banned the Confederate flag from being flown at those races. And that's particularly exciting for me because I remember in 2008, I was 18 years old.
Shout out to who?
Barack Obama.
Bubba Wallace.
Oh, shout out to Bubba Wallace.
Because he called them out on their bullshit.
That's right.
And he's gorgeous.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I digress.
Keep in your pants.
Time to go to that wine tasting.
In 2008, I was a big Barack Obama supporter in the primary between Obama and Hillary Clinton, and I went to a NASCAR race in Talladega, Alabama, and the only shirt that I remember to pack was my Obama 08 shirt. And my father, to this day, does not forgive me for the time that I wore an Obama 08 shirt to a NASCAR race in Talladega, Alabama. And it was not a very friendly crowd, Lorenzo.
I believe you.
And so...
After I did that, I really think I could do anything. It really set the stage for my political activism and running for Senate in Deep East Texas as a Democrat. But whenever I heard that NASCAR banned the Confederate flag, I was so excited about it because I don't understand, as a white dude from East Texas, Deep South, from a family that is, you know, Confederate sympathizers. Let's just throw it
that
out there,
that might throw bacon grease in your face.
Right, those folks. love them, but, you know, they're over there. To me, my perspective, I've never understood why people are so, who claim to be so pro-America, pro-troops, the real patriots, real Americans, are waving a treason flag and bragging about how they support this flag that represents treason against the United States government. So what I've been obsessed with this week is that things that do not insult the American flag, kneeling. Things that do insult the American flag, waving a fucking treason flag every chance you get. Good for you, NASCAR. I'm proud of you. Glad to be a NASCAR fan, and that's what I've been completely obsessed with. And that was obsessed!
I didn't know NASCAR existed.
If you have something that you've been obsessed with this week, make sure to send your video of 30 seconds or fewer to info@podblesstexas.com. We might play it on the next show.
Wow, that was something. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Doctor. I know you got to get back on your fundraising calls because I think you guys have a deadline on June 15th, if I'm not mistaken.
We've got a deadline and an election to win. But I appreciate you all having me on this show. I want to come back.
Okay, great. And if people want to follow you, they can follow you on your website is again.
Yeah, it's Gandhi, G-A-N-D-H-I, GandhiForTexas.com, or at my Twitter handle, @Pritesh, P-R-I-T-E-S-H, Gandhi, G-A-N-D-H-I-M-D, @PriteshGandhiMD.
Well, we so enjoyed you, and just wishing you all the luck, and thank your family for us for being part of the way to win back that seat that we need to win back. And I know it's a team effort, and you got a great team.
It's a team effort. My three daughters are being very quiet in the room right over. I'll make sure that I let them know.
We're proud of you and the work that you're doing district. Lily, if people wanted to follow you, where would they go to do it?
They can follow me through Pod Bless Texas or through my Twitter account, which is Lillian_Salerno.
You almost forgot that.
Yeah, I did. I don't.
Lorenzo Boutram Hubbard, where can people go to follow you?
On Twitter, the gay socialite. And on Instagram, Lorenzo Boutram Hubbard.
I like the way you enunciate Twitter.
It's Twitter. Twitter. On the Twitter. Yes.
And if folks wanted to follow me, they could find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok machine at Kendall Scudder, where I will be dropping in Pritesh Gandhi's mentions a lot these days because I'm very impressed by that guy.
Yeah, me too. All right, and we thank everybody for listening, and thanks for joining us, and feel free to subscribe if you want. We are already have lots of subscribers, but we always welcome more, and thank everybody for joining us.
For the last episode of this season.
Oh, yeah, right.
I'm in the season finale!
All right,
I love it!
We'll be back in your podcast stores in the middle of July, so pay attention to that.
Yeah. And thanks for joining us, and on behalf of all of us here at Pod Bless Texas and Kendall and I, have a blessed week.
See you next month!
Thank you all.